This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this Friday the 13th. We have a great show here at the end of the week on this program. Friday the 13th, the day before Valentine's Day. Lots to talk about, but we begin in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
They were gems of their communities and left a lasting impression on the people around them. They inspired us. They served as role models to the youth. We ask that you celebrate the memories of our family members.
That's Suzanne Barakat, the sister of Dia Barakat, speaking at the very well-attended funeral for Dia, Yusor Muhammad Abu Salah, and Razan Muhammad Abu Salah, the three people killed in Chapel Hill. While police in North Carolina struggled with words and legal fine print, hate crime, parking crime, crazy guy, anti-Muslim terrorist, the world, particularly the Muslim community, has moved beyond the crime story from last weekend to a bigger story of silence, of protest, of remembrance of three brilliant young Muslim Americans struck down by an angry man determined to snuff out their promising lives. A local crime has become a global discussion of tolerance and intolerance in America. The Muslim president of Turkey has criticized President Barack Obama for his silence over the murder of the students. If you stay silent when faced with an incident like this and don't make a statement, the world will stay silent towards you, President Erdogan said on Thursday. There is a feeling across the globe that Muslims are saying enough about something. Could it be this, that hate crimes against Muslims in this country have consistently hovered in the range of 100 to 150 per year? Could it be an absence of Muslim faces in media and culture in America? Familiar signs of marginalization other groups in this country have faced. Is this a watershed moment for Muslims in America? I'm joined now by Nawa Arsala, a second-year law student at American University in Washington, D.C. Also with me is Wajahat Ali, co-host and digital producer of The Stream on Al Jazeera America. Wajahat Ali, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
And Nawa Arsala, welcome to you.
Hi, John.
Would you say that there is a generational discussion of how to respond to this situation in North Carolina that maybe the old guard would say, be quiet about all of this, and that a younger generation has different ideas about how to express themselves in the American democracy, Nawa?
Here, just last night, I went to a candlelight vigil for the victims of Chapel Hill. And my mom, I called her beforehand, you know, this is what I'm doing. And she's like, you can't go. Absolutely not. It's dangerous. And you just see what happened. And then for the younger generation, we identify, you know, as Americans. So all we understand our right to gather and to protest. And for my family that immigrated from Afghanistan, anything like this is terrifying to them. And they just think we should put our heads down, just let it go. But for us, these victims, we can identify so much. They were students like us. They volunteered. They were passionate. They were kind. And this is the first time, like, students here in D.C. and all over America that are Muslim American, we could put a face to some of the terrible things that have been happening right now.
And I'm wondering if this is a Muslim thing, because I'm reminded of the immigrant history in the United States, where first-generation folks were very much about being quiet, and that whatever the circumstances of a crime like this, that there is a well-perceived jealousy that exists among individuals in sort of the white community over immigrants who are successful and, you know, going to college and doing exactly what these three individuals were doing. And that can be expressed in a kind of hatred and jealousy. And that's well established in America. Wajahat, would you say?
It is. I mean, you know, my mother, I haven't been doing this for several years. And to this day, she, even about 2 days ago, she said, Wajahat, be careful. You're very public. There's some crazy people out there right now. We're living in interesting times. And there is this mindset of the immigrant community, and it's done out of love and concern. Don't rock the boat. Keep your head down. Just play it straight and narrow. Don't air the dirty laundry. You know, just let a few other people be the loud voices. You be behind the scenes. And it isn't to minimize the tragedy. It isn't to take away your voice. It is out of safety and concern. And as Nawa was saying, it seems the new generation, especially for me, you know, I was a college student in 9/11. This has been repeated baptism by fire. It is a tragedy that forces people to wake up and speak for themselves, to become protagonists, if you will, for their narrative, to reclaim the American narrative, and to be at the fault lines of where, what really means to be American right now, you know? And we should be the ones who should actually act as agents of healing and change.
And I think because this is a, all right, we've had enough feeling being expressed in North Carolina and around the world, this goes way beyond this incident and this tragic shooting. It seems to me when you say reclaim the narrative of Muslims in America, I can tick off a list of people who have taken that narrative. You've got certain critical media voices, some of which you hear maybe on Fox News. You've got ISIS, who claims they have the narrative of what it means to be Muslim. You've got people like this accused murderer in North Carolina. And you have overtly expressed hatred against Muslims. I'm thinking of some of the crimes against Muslims right after 9/11. Is this protest movement fighting against all of those individuals who would claim the narrative of Muslims for themselves, Noah?
I think one point I'd like to make is I think the reason why the older generation maybe asked us to keep our heads down was because they were trying to assimilate here. And they understood that to assimilate into the United States, they had to acquire some different beliefs. And they can't act like they're living in Afghanistan anymore. They can't act like they're living anywhere else. They're here now. So for us, we're American. And at this point, we're older now. And we've been silent for so long, I feel like. And things have just progressively gotten worse and worse. And finally, we have a platform. And we have, unfortunately, these amazing three students that have been kind of the poster children for this Islamophobia that we've been dealing with for so long. And the other discussion that was really, really popular last night was in regards to the media. There was this very interesting thing that we have been retweeting and posting on Facebook. Was this algorithm for the news of Islamophobia. It's just this little picture, and it says, well, are the victims Muslim? Yes or no? If they are Muslim, you ask yourself, could they have done something to bring this upon themselves? A lot of people there were saying, you know, how come this question is never asked? That question is only asked depending on the person's appearance or the color of their skin. That's never asked when, you know, if the victims were just white Americans. So a lot of discussion yesterday was anger with the media. Aside from what has happened with the tragedy, it's been more about the coverage on it, let it be the lack thereof, or just how it's been skewed. I mean, I personally, the way I described it was a terrorist killing three American students. And I actually, for the first time, you know, for my whole life, I've been clouded by this idea of being a Muslim and terrorism and this and that. And the first time in my life yesterday, I looked up in the dictionary, what is terrorism? And there is no picture or description of a bearded man or a person wearing a hijab. It just says using intimidation and violence to push political gains. That could be absolutely anybody. That is not a specific Islamic terrorism interpretation. So I think that, you know, the Muslims in America now and the youth, everything is just bottled up for so long, and now we're finally responding.
Wajahat?
Yeah, I mean, what Nawaz says is oftentimes for American Muslims, and going back to your question, our story has been told to us by others. And the story that's been told after 9/11 is that apparently there's a civilizational conflict between Islam, whatever that means, and the West, whatever that means. And if you're not telling your story, John, others are telling it for you. And unfortunately, Muslims as a collective have emerged, if you will, as this global antagonist, especially in America. And what I always say is worse than being even an antagonist is to be a sidekick and to be irrelevant, to be a footnote in history. And I think what Noah was saying is this has not happened in an isolated incident. This tragedy happened in this political, social context where, you know, there's anti-Sharia legislation being introduced in 32 states. I mean, nationwide protests against mosques. We have elected officials like Texas State Senator Molly White, who's making Muslims pledge allegiance to the flag as if being Muslim simultaneously means you're anti-American or your loyalty is perpetually suspect. You know, you have the Charlie Hebdo parachuting attacks. And as a result, you have, quote unquote, mainstream people saying, where are the moderate Muslims? They need to apologize and they need to condemn this murder, a double standard that is not applied to anyone else. And so honestly, it's one of those situations where I also blame American Muslims, especially the younger generation and the older generation, because we haven't told our story. Now for the L generation, and I empathize with them, I'm a new father, they wanted safety and success for their children. They had to mainstream through hazing, come to a new country for 2/3 who are immigrants, of course, there's also African-American Muslims, learn a new language, right? Build the American dream, build your mosque in the liquor shop, go drive 2 states to get halal meat. And you know, you keep your head down, you get made fun of, you get humiliated. And once they made it with the American dream, they said, here is the recipe of success. Everything was supposed to be okay. But you know, things aren't okay right now. And so now you see this young generation who feels just as much as American as they do Muslim. And we're seeing the fissures, the fault lines, the tensions of what it means to be Muslim in America right now. And I think also what's really profound, what it means to be American in 2015.
Well, it really brings almost a tear to my eye, because you could take out Muslim from everything you're saying, Wajahat, and now put in Irish,
That's right.
In Catholic, put in African-American. I mean, there's the slave narrative in African-American history, but still, you could put all those groups in there, and it's the same story, and to hear and feel Muslims joining that story is a very, very powerful statement from both of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Wajahat Ali is co-host and digital producer of The Stream on Al Jazeera America. Nawa Arsala is a second-year law student at American University in Washington, D.C. We sure want you to be a part of that conversation. You can react to anything that's been said on the program at 877-8MYTAKE or post a comment to thetakeaway.org. You know, I'm sick of superlatives. I'm sick of remembering. I'm sick this week of goodbyes. I'm sick of obits. But oh, you could never be sick of writer and Times media critic David Carr.
For those of us who work in media, life is a drumbeat of goodbye speeches with sheet cakes and cheap sparkling wine. That carnage has left behind an island of misfit toys, like model trains whose cabooses have square wheels.
Carr died yesterday at the chirping young age of 58. He collapsed in the Times newsroom and died at the nearby hospital, where he was taken by ambulance. Carr was the life of every party he ever attended. It almost killed him, and you can read about it in his memoir of addiction and recovery, The Night of the Gun. Carr's dinner conversations made you forget any celebrity chef, maybe because he always talked through dinner, barely touching his food. He was always thin as a rail. He was a delightfully grumpy old curmudgeon about digital journalism. He was a heroic advocate for the values of traditional newspapers. But he was beloved in the digital world. Reports of his death exploded online, his blogs and columns widely read. To be attacked by David Carr was the highest of compliments.
This sort of decades of organizational hubris about, you know, our own excellence and our own dominance, and then in a matter of like 18 months, all of a sudden there was the air ionized the situation, and everybody started like asking a question, could the New York Times like go out of business?
He was undoubtedly the best media critic of his generation, understanding all media, the new without any gee whiz hype, the traditional without any sanctimonious pap. How will we live without his takedowns of the glitzy ballroom stars of Hollywood and his voice of gravel and burlap?
There's something that happens when you get on that red carpet at the Oscars where I think there's some fumes that come off it that rob you of at least 20 to 30 IQ points. And then you have all this screaming in the background, which doesn't really sort of help your chi in terms of focusing.
Hard living, tough talking, and his love of life and the times he worked for made him larger than life. His passing tangibly shrinks the world. For all the renegades in the world, he was always coming out of a door they were stepping into. David Carr, he's been there. He's done that.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In late January, a federal judge ruled Alabama's ban on same-sex marriage unconstitutional, paving the way for same-sex couples to wed in one of the most conservative states in our nation. But Chief Justice Roy Moore at the state court level responded by ordering all probate judges and employees in Alabama to follow existing state law and not issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples or recognize same-sex marriages. Justice Moore is famous for his endorsement of a two-ton public monument of the Ten Commandments, defying a federal court order to remove it and eventually being removed from office himself. But he's back. In an interview on ABC earlier this week, Justice Moore was asked if he was worried about being on the wrong side of history.
Wrong side of history? Absolutely not. Did they stop with one man and one man, or one woman and one woman? Or did they go to multiple marriages? Or did they go to marriages between men and their daughters or women and their sons?
To discuss the curious history of states' rights and the federal courts in Alabama, Doug Jones joins us. He's a former U.S. attorney in Alabama. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, John. Appreciate it.
Doug, I want to play something for you from 1963. It's very familiar to people in Alabama, maybe less familiar to other Americans. Here's former Alabama governor, the late George Wallace, back in 1963.
In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
Doug Jones, George Wallace argued that there was some sort of natural law which superseded the federal government, and he used that as a justification for segregation. Do you see anything similar going on here with Judge Moore?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there are differences, but make no mistake, with regard to legal procedures and those kind of things. But in terms of the public reaction, the public statements of not only Judge Moore, but other public officials in this state, it's absolutely, the parallels are striking.
In a week where we're all grappling with the issue of what is or is not a hate crime, what is or is not racism, what is or is not xenophobia, is there something we need to understand about Judge Moore and this question of George Wallace, who's understood by history to be a racist?
Well, the main thing that I think people often miss is that George Wallace did so much just to advance his political career. The people that knew George Wallace well back in his college and early career did not believe he was racist. All of this was done to advance a political career. And there is a growing sense of feeling in this state that this is the same thing with Judge Moore, that yes, he does have these religious beliefs. But just like he used the Ten Commandments issue several years ago to advance a political career, which ultimately fell flat.
So intolerance in the pursuit of a political advantage is a federal crime, in your view, if he's defying the federal government here?
Well, when you say a federal crime, I mean, certainly I think that ultimately if he defies court orders, as he did with the Ten Commandments order from a federal judge several years ago, it could be an issue of sanctions. Whether or not somebody could be convicted of a crime is a whole different story other than just simply of contempt. But remember, Judge Moore is not a party to this lawsuit at this point. He is the Chief Justice. He is in issuing orders to state court judges about what they should or should not do with regard to this order. As we've gone on this week, these orders are getting clarified. More and more of the counties in Alabama are basically saying, Judge, you're wrong. We're going to follow what the U.S. District Judge in Mobile has said, and we're going to follow the law. So I think there can be sanctions. Whether or not it's a federal crime, though, I think it's going to be I'm not sure about that.
Well, I was deliberately overstating there just to try to elaborate on what the question is here. But you mentioned the counties. From the perspective of the Supreme Court, is this states' rights idea settled law at this point?
If you're talking about from the U.S. Supreme Court, I don't think it's settled right now. I mean, most people believe that the handwriting is on the wall, that the U.S. Supreme Court this summer is going to basically overturn all of these gay marriage bans that have been passed across the country. And remember, most of these bans, Alabama's getting a lot of publicity right now, primarily because of Judge Moore. But so many of the states passed these anti-same-sex marriage constitutional amendments that have been overturned not by voters but by federal judges over the last couple of 3 years. And so I think the Supreme Court has to weigh in at this point. They've accepted a case, and this issue is going to be decided, I think, one way or another, barring some other act of Congress or some other constitutional amendment that is going to be floated around the country these days.
Now, I know you're a former U.S. attorney and you speak with precision and value that. I understand that well. But what do you make of this language in this ABC interview of Justice Moore, where he says, do they stop with one man and one man, or one woman and one woman, or do they go to multiple marriages? Do they go to marriages between men and their daughters, women and their sons? What do you make of that kind of speech?
I think that that is hate-filled speech. I think that that is pandering to the folks in this country who believe that the president was born in Kenya. I believe it panders to the far right of people who are anti-federal government. And there is a segment of a huge segment in Alabama, but across the country, there's a segment of the population who is so anti-federal government that those kind of things, when they say they, that's what he's referring to. He's talking about the federal government, particularly the Obama administration. And it's the same kind of rhetoric that we have seen particularly in the South and Alabama in the past. But I think you also see it. You see this today. You looking around Congress, you've seen some of the same kind of rhetoric when you really think about it on the immigration issues and on other civil rights issues of the day. It's the same kind of code words that pander to the worst part of people.
Doug Jones is a former U.S. attorney and the man who led the team of prosecutors and investigators in the reopened historic cold case of the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Doug, thanks so much.
My pleasure, John. Anytime.
Love hurts. Love's gone. Listen to me. I don't do romance. My tastes are very singular. You wouldn't understand.
A little bit of our soundtrack there, but that dialogue or monologue there is from 50 Shades of Grey. That's Christian Grey explaining things to Anastasia there. This weekend, 50 Shades of Grey is expected to dominate the box office with $60 million in ticket sales. Domination is big business now. The book, 50 Shades of Grey, has also been cited as the reason behind increased sales of sex toys, brisk trade in BDSM titles, that's bondage, domination, sadism, and masochism titles on the paperback shelves. Cindy Gallup is the creator of the website Make Love Not Porn and the author of Make Love Not Porn, Technology's Hardcore Impact on Human Behavior. Cindy, welcome back.
Delighted to be here, John.
Happy 50 Shades of Grey Friday the 13th.
Thank you.
There's been talk that a movie like this, not unlike what happens in hardcore porn, raises expectations among couples and particularly among young people who are entering sexual relationships for the first time. Do you think 50 Shades of Grey raises an expectation that you gotta like handcuffs to be normal?
Well, I'm very conflicted about 50 Shades of Grey, John, because there are three reasons I hate it and there are three reasons I love it. The three reasons I
hate... Now, is this the whole phenomenon or just the movie?
Actually, the book and the movie.
Okay.
Because I saw the movie last night and I feel the same way about it as I did the book. So the three reasons I hate 50 Shades of Grey are, a very badly written book and actually not a particularly riveting movie. B, it's the Mills and Boone Cinderella story, you know, knight in a white charger rescues woman but in modern day clothes. And C, it has all the hallmarks of a thoroughly abusive relationship. Three reasons I hate it. The reasons I love it are, to your point, it de-kinkifies sex that many more people would be thoroughly enjoying if society hadn't told them, oh, it's kinky, you can't do that. It has obviously galvanized, and the movie will galvanize, and refresh a number of relationships and marriages. And a third reason I love it is because it does exactly what we're doing with Make Love Not Porn. It socializes sex. It brings it out in the open, and it makes it socially acceptable and shareable. And those are three very good things.
And those 6 points there really cast 50 Shades of Grey in the same role that erotic Victorian literature had, that it was all about male domination. It was all about the patriarchy. It had all the worst habits of the Victorian age. But it also was a therapeutic corrective to bringing sex out into the open, making people more fundamentally honest, and sort of getting rid of all of these pretensions about sexuality and allowing people to have more fun. So I guess that's a good thing on balance.
It is. And but at the same time, and forgive the dreadful pun, it's a very gray area because as I say, there are pros and there are cons. And the one thing I will say about the movie is that, call me old-fashioned, but I would have liked a whole lot more sex in it, and I would have liked a whole lot more of Jamie Dornan naked. And I think that was a real missed opportunity because the movie world as a whole has gone backwards. If 50 Shades of Grey had been made in the 70s, we would have seen some really interesting, authentic depictions of dominant submissive sex. And we would also have seen a whole lot more of Jamie Dornan full frontal versus restricting that as Hollywood does to the woman.
So more male nudity and more edge if this was in the 70s.
Absolutely. And when I say edge, I don't just mean graphic. I mean literally a really interesting exploration of sexuality as a fundamental human driver and of what people really do and how messy, conflicted, ridiculous, wonderful and beautiful we all are when it comes to real world sex.
So there's a lot of hype about, oh, I've got a great secret to tell you. But then when you actually hear the secret, it's like nothing important at all. Hollywood has Hollywoodized this whole notion of secret sex.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, Fifty Shades glosses over all of that in a way that actually isn't doing justice to the really interesting things about BDSM as a way of sexual exploration, of releasing all sorts of things that people often don't examine within themselves. There's a really, really interesting examination we made there. And unfortunately, the movie is very superficial when it comes to that.
All right. So what do you say to the people who are, you know, driving or, you know, have their kids in the back seat and are, you know, now screaming about they're never going to contribute to public radio again because they're talking about BDSM, how do you make the point that this should be out in the open? Forget 50 Shades of Grey, that this is something that's worth exploring, that's healthy to actually talk about.
Well, to your point, to every parent squawking right now about the fact we're having this conversation, I would say, do something for me. Go to Google, enter the word porn into the search box, as millions of kids do every day. Take a look at the 10 sites that will come up on the first page of Google when you do that. Go to each of those sites, take a long, hard look at that homepage, and then tell us we shouldn't be having this conversation. I'm all for anything that forces more open, healthy discussion around sex in the real world, because that will absolutely prevent many, many things that will make you and your children very unhappy unless you adopt a more open, healthy, and honest attitude towards the fact that we all have sex, we all enjoy it, and it needs to be talked about.
If you don't preempt the expectations about sexuality by open, honest discussion, then those expectations will be determined by disgusting websites, abusive websites, or bad movies like Fifty Shades of Grey.
Absolutely.
Do you think 50 Shades of Grey has changed anything? The sales of toys, the branding of handcuffs?
Oh, absolutely, Joel. And obviously I'm biased because, again, this is what my own startup, Make Love Not Porn, is all about. But I love the fact that 50 Shades is the first socially acceptable, socially shareable erotica out there. It has demonstrated the enormous amount of money to be made out of socially acceptable sex. Right now, at this point in time, E.L. James is the single highest income grossing author in the world. She has out-earned Dan Brown, Michael Crichton, Jim Patterson, and it also demonstrates the power of something I say a lot, which is that there is a huge amount of money to be made out of taking women seriously.
So, Cindy, you should write the well-written sex book.
I'm not a writer. I am absolutely about helping this conversation. I do that with Make Love Not Porn, but I couldn't write it.
Cindy Gallup, the creator of the website Make Love Not Porn and the author of Make Love Not Porn, Technology's Hardcore Impact on Human Behavior. Thanks so much, Cindy.
Pleasure to be here.
For better or worse, a lot of discussion about a topic that you may find taboo to talk about in public. What do you think is so difficult to talk openly and honestly about sex in America? Paul Green Beckenstein writes to us on Facebook, "It's a subject filled with unresolved shame for women, either because so many girls have grown up with images of women as sexual objects and they learn to associate desire with pornography, or because parents implicitly teach their daughters to repress their desires." That's Paula Green Beckenstein. 877-8 My Take is our number. Much more at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Would you like a formula for love? Ah, that it would be as simple as making a martini. Three ingredients, shaken together with ice, add an olive oil, a twist, and perfection. Look at the person next to you and suddenly, true love. Well, martinis can end badly, as many of you perhaps already understand. And so a scientist, Arthur Aaron, after some study many years ago, offered a more rigorous method. Number one, find two people looking for love. Two, have them answer a specific series of 36 questions openly and honestly. And then, and this is the olive, have them stare into each other's eyes without speaking for exactly 4 minutes. Dr. Aaron did lots of trials of this and discovered that the method didn't just lead to sparks in intimacy. Two of the study subjects actually married each other less than 6 months later. Writer Mandy Len Catron decided to put this scientific method to the test in her real love life with a man she barely knew, basically a stranger. Now she has a name for him, boyfriend.
So we were acquaintances, but we did this study just sort of on a whim for fun. And I didn't know, it was the first time we'd ever hung out one-on-one.
What was the line? I mean, you said, hi, I don't really know you. You seem kind of cool. Yeah, right. No. I have this like thing I want to do. And
No.
I mean, guys will do anything, right?
We're out having a drink and just sort of talking about relationships. I ended up talking to people about love a lot because I research and write about it. And so he said to me, I think I have this theory that given a certain number of commonalities, you could fall in love with almost anyone. And I was kind of like, well, you know, I'm not sure if that's true or not. But then I remembered this study and I said, well, someone's actually done some research on that topic. And I didn't know if we were on a date or not on a date, but I was interested enough to say, well, let's try it. And he's a really good sport. So he was like, okay, sure. And so, you know, we just did.
So what are the questions and would you have asked them under any circumstances if you didn't know about this research?
Some of them you might ask. Like they begin very casual and get increasingly intimate. So some are like, would you like to be famous and in what way? Or what would be your perfect day? Like these are questions that I would ask someone, but then they get a lot more intimate really quickly. And I think those are the kind of questions that are maybe a little bit more intimidating to ask someone. Like here's one, if you could wake up tomorrow having gained any one quality or ability, what would it be? I mean, they're interesting questions, but not necessarily questions that you would think to pose to somebody you don't know very well, or maybe that you would even be very comfortable posing to somebody you don't know very well.
What would your answer to that question be?
I would want to teleport. I live really far away from my family and I'd love to be able to just pop over and visit them for the weekend.
Nice. And take me through the 4 minutes as you've experienced it. I mean, the first 15 seconds are like, whoa. And then you're a minute in and you're going, okay, this is taking some time. Then I suspect there's some sort of transformation that takes place, you know, after like minute two or three.
Yeah. So I think it took me about, the guy I did it with, my boyfriend, he is like this really calm, sort of placid, relaxed human. And I'm kind of not. So he was a great person to do it with because he just sort of had this like calm, relaxed smile. And he just sort of went for it. And I was so nervous. I could hardly breathe. I think for the first 2 minutes, I was like focusing on breathing properly and trying to relax and trying not to laugh. There's a lot of smiling. And then eventually, which is why I think you should do it for 4 minutes instead of two, because it's been reported variously in different places for different lengths of time. But I think, you know, after about the second minute, I was able to relax. And it took me that long. It took half the time to get to that point. But once I did, there's something pretty profound about looking at someone and letting someone really look at you for 4 minutes straight. I mean, it's terrifying, but I think also once you kind of let that experience in, it can be pretty powerful. I mean, you really have to let your guard down.
Well, and then he was more than a good sport.
Well, yeah. So we developed a friendship very quickly starting that night, and then we started spending a lot of time together. But we really waited to think about whether or not we wanted to pursue a romantic relationship. So it's not like we fell in love while we're staring into each other's eyes.
But, you know, you took a pretty important first step, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I think maybe there are a lot of people out there who want to be intimate with someone, who want to be really vulnerable, but who need a mechanism that enables them to do that. And this study provides a way in.
Now, does that mean that we're more selective if we decide to fall in love with someone by, you know, doing one of these kind of love potion-y sort of things? Or does it mean we're less selective, that it could happen kind of with anyone?
I guess my sense is that you get to be more selective. Like my experience with love has always been that it was this really overwhelming thing that would just happen to me. and I didn't feel like I had a choice about it. And I would fall for these guys who weren't necessarily the kind of people I would maybe want to make a life with, but they were, you know, attractive or artistic or moody. I mean, especially when I was younger. And I think I like the idea of having more agency in that process and saying, you know, these are the qualities that are really valuable to me in another person. And finding someone who has those qualities and really pursuing a romantic relationship with them. I mean, I think all of us would like to do it that way instead of just let love sort of force us into whatever.
Now, a lot of
whatever
people,
relationship right. sort of happens.
Now, a lot of people would listen to what you're saying and go, all right, she's talking about the difference between Mr. Right and, you know, Mr. Right Now or Ms.
Yeah,
Right
sure.
or Ms. Right Now. But you're suggesting that there might be a whole other group in the middle that's, you know, Mr. Right for a while. That's also love.
If you do much research into romantic love, you know, like I think very quickly the idea of a soulmate kind of flies out the window. Like I don't buy into that myth. I think you can fall in love with any number of people. And if that's true, like if we accept that it's possible to fall in love with any number of people, why not fall in love with someone who's just really wonderful and fits your life really nicely? That's much easier said than done, of course. But I like that idea. I think that makes sense.
It's great to talk to you, and happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah, thanks. Same to you. Happy Valentine's Day.
Mandy Len Catron teaches writing at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver and is working on a book about the dangers of love stories. You can read her work at thelovestoryproject.ca. Thinking of 50 Shades of Grey, we want to think about the 50 Days of White. For those people in the Northeast around this time of year, they're getting ready for another snowstorm. We're going to play some of your 50 words for snow, a little poetry on the program to help those sick of having to dig themselves out. You can respond to anything you heard today by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Share your 50 words for snow with my good pal Todd Zwillick, who will be here on Monday. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
For The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.